Welcome to the 20th addendum episode of undisclosed coverage of the state versus Dennis Perry. Rabia here. I get to host this week, edging out John Cryer. Feel really important doing that. But anyway, we have Susan with us this week. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rabia.
And a couple of great guests. We have Dr. Marcia Chatlin, who our listeners are familiar with. And Marcia is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown. And she's the author of the forthcoming book about fast food and civil rights entitled From Sit-In to Drive-Through. Welcome back to the show, Marcia.
Hi, Rabia. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just want to add that chicken nuggets are way more interesting than you ever would have thought.
Oh, my God. So fascinating. I have even more.
Ever since I saw that video years ago of the paste, anyway, we also have a very special guest with us, Janie Everett. She is the founder of the Theocle Memorial Project, dedicated to the 1971 explosion of the Theocle plant in Woodbine. Welcome to the show, Janie.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Janie, how should Rabia be saying the name of the plant?
I know. Am I saying it right?
It's Theocle.
Oh, my God. You know, if only I had known like 3 days ago. Okay. Say that again, Janie.
Theocle. Theocle.
Theocle. I call. Not at all how it looks on paper. Okay. To me, at least. All right. Theocle. We'll go with Theocle. Okay. We're going to start off. Can you tell us a little bit about the Memorial Project to begin with?
The Theocle Memorial Project is dedicated to the memory of the 30 fallen patriots and the remaining 570 workers that worked at the Theocle chemical plant. Also, we're dedicated to recognizing the compassion and courage of all of the first responders from the 15 cities and the Army, Navy, and the Coast Guard that went in to try and save lives, and they did save lives that day, and how the community and the three states got together, and they overcame devastation.
What moved you to begin this project?
Well, what moved me to begin the project was that children surfing on the internet, and they came across this information about the Theocle explosion. And they were my nieces and nephews. My mother is a survivor of the explosion, and also their mother's grandmother was killed, Miss Ethel Banks. She was killed at the plant, and these children didn't know the history. And when I reviewed the history online, I realized that the 29 people that they had online, it was incorrect. The information was incorrect.
They had the two men listed, right?
Yeah, they had Mr. Chapman, James L. Chapman, and then they had Leonard Chapman. And I said, wait a minute, there was never two brothers killed in this explosion. There was a twin, but not two brothers, but there were two sisters. And one of the sisters' names was not on the list, and that was May Alice Taylor. There's two sisters, Betty Jean Roberts and May Alice Taylor, are both from Florida. But they duplicated Mr. Chapman. His name is James Leonard Chapman. They put James L. Chapman and Leonard Chapman. So I said, you know, this has to be corrected, and these children need to be taught the history so that they will understand the love that these people have for the country, the dignity, the struggle, and how they overcame all of these shortcomings because they believed and they were very hopeful.
You showed me a book of history in Camden County. It's a pretty big book, pretty exhaustive. And then the section,
559-page Camden County book is called Camden Challenge. And on page 190, they have 3/4 of a page dedicated to Theocle and only two lines referencing the explosion. And they say that it's the worst tragedy in Camden County history. It occurred on February the 3rd. 1971, where 29 workers were killed and 50 or more injured. But then the salt in the wound was the alcohol chemical plant was generous to the families of the deceased and the injured workers. And I was like, this is all that you have to say. They reduced them to a number and didn't even name their names in a 559-page book.
And it wasn't even accurate, because the idea that the alcohol was somehow generous to them isn't really supported.
No, they had to fight 17 years in court. Justice had to rewrite mass tort litigation. They lost to Thiokol because of workman's comp. And the government lost 5 different times. And these people were still suffering. And they were getting notices from Thiokol that, you know, in the beginning that they would be fired if they didn't return to work. And some of them weren't able to return to work. So it was a lot of things going on and families moving on in the 17 years. But the amazing thing about the people that we remember in this community, in this area, is that of all the people that were killed, none of their children went into foster homes. The families and the community were strong. They bought food, they bought clothes, they held these kids together. They built a daycare center dedicated to taking care of the kids that were orphaned by this explosion and to take care of the children once the workers went back to work.
So, yeah, we didn't cover this in the episode, but the factory didn't close down after this explosion. It did reopen fairly quickly. And if the employees weren't back very quickly, they were going to lose their jobs.
Yes, they had a March memo that went out to the workers, and some of them, we have it on display in the museum. Some of the workers got the notice that if they did not return to work, that they were in violation of their union rules in their union book. So, the plant exploded on February the 3rd, and the letters were dated March the 5th. But if you go to our website, you would see that Harold Anderson returned to work within, 2 weeks, and he just couldn't stay. They cleaned up. That plant went on operating. As a matter of fact, those buildings that were destroyed were rebuilt within a year. They could not go back to manufacturing trip layers because there was stop work order because they did not know what caused the explosion. And so they just continued making 81 millimeters, the CS deterrent gases, and other munitions.
Yeah. And so as an attorney, I'm obviously interested in the litigation side of it and the recoveries. And it definitely was not a model of how this sort of litigation should be done. It went on forever, which is not uncommon, but the 17 years is longer than most of these cases go.
It's egregious. That's egregious,
and
yeah.
The ultimate recoveries were, I would say, they're very small given the scale of the disaster. The individual recoveries were relatively limited. Today, if this, God forbid, it happened today, I think you'd see a very, very different outcome. Although one thing that could be true, too, is that Thiokol was not held liable in any way. They had workers' comp. That was their method of compensation, and they were only held to that. It was the federal government who ultimately was liable for not informing Thiokol that they were actually dealing with highly explosive materials. Although I would argue that Thiokol probably, it seems like that it wasn't just the government that dropped the ball there.
Well, I mean, the memo telling Thiokol to take protective measures did not get to the plant until 3 weeks after the explosion. And that memo was never revealed until years later when Chapman and Cox, they had private attorneys. They were the two company men from Marshall, Texas. Their attorneys discovered it in a desk drawer of a lieutenant that had been transferred out to Vietnam. And that's what, you know, took this entire case in a different direction. But some people never got paid.
A lot didn't. It's surprising.
Yeah, I mean, they sued the federal government for $700 million, and they got less than $25 million. And after 17 years of fighting, you can imagine there were attorney fees and different things. So they just, some people got no money because of the statute of limitations. And some people got minimum money. But when you consider that we are a country that we're paying money to Vietnam to clean up the cluster bombs, millions of dollars. And I think some arrangements were made in 2016. So if we are trying to repay and straighten out the ills of war for people that we fought to bring freedom to, then what about our people? So we built a monument to recognize the Vietnam veterans, which they earned it. Truthfully, they did. What we're asking is that America stand up now and understand that this great fighting force that we have cannot fight without supplies. An army cannot march without boots, and they cannot defend liberty and freedom without munitions or ammunition or all the things that they need to defend. And our people have been left behind.
Let's be honest, most of us will never know how much the things we buy cost to actually make. But let's say you did. Would you buy a t-shirt for $50 if you knew it only cost $7 to make? It's fair to say that I wouldn't. And with Everlane, well, I don't ever have to overpay for quality clothing again. Everlane only makes premium essentials like t-shirts, using the finest materials available without any traditional markups. And they tell you their real cost. They tell you what it costs to get the material, what it costs to make it. I mean, who does that, you know? So you know that you are never overpaying. Everlane sells directly to you, and that's why their prices are 30 to 50% lower than traditional retailers. They're so radically transparent. Every step in the process, they want you to see it, from the materials they use to the ethical factories they work with. And the clothes are beautiful. They look better, cost less, and they last longer. Essentials like their Cotton Crew t-shirt, exactly what they should be. The simple, stylish, and made from quality materials. A couple of my favorite items from Everlane are the Day Heel and the Day Flat. These are just beautifully made shoes, I can't tell you. They are just buttery Italian leather, and they're gonna be essentials that I'm gonna use probably until I retire. I mean, these are gorgeous shoes, and most of my shoes, I'm not joking, they're just kind of all over the place, but I keep these shoes in their boxes because they are that pretty, and they are that special. Everlane's timeless essentials are exactly what you're looking for. There's no frills, just quality. I mean, really beautifully made essential clothing and shoes and handbags. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention my clutch. This gorgeous black leather clutch that I've taken to a couple of special occasions that people have asked me, where'd you get that? Beautifully made. So right now you can check out our personalized collection at everlane.com/undisclosed, and you'll get free shipping on your first order. Don't miss it. That's everlane.com/undisclosed, so you can look as styling and classy as the rest of us over here at Undisclosed. everlane.com/undisclosed. Check out our personalized collection and get free shipping on your first order.
You've done an amazing job of putting these together and finding materials and photos of all the people involved. And actually walking through your museum is kind of interesting to see like all the names I recognize from other stuff in Camden County, because.
Yeah. How like, did you do that, Janie? Yeah. I'm curious about like, you know, the effort to collect all of the documentation for the museum.
Well, it's just a small corner that we have touched upon. What happens is a lot of the workers are still living, or their family members are somewhere across the country. Once we began putting together or collecting artifacts and people found out, they began bringing their artifacts to us. We've had people come as far away as Alabama and Ohio here to bring us their artifacts or something that belonged to a family member. And my mother is still living. There was a lady, her name was Dorothy Mornack. Her husband had been the engineer at Vicol. And before she died, she worked in the project. And she used to make phone calls. And she would say, listen, I can't do email. I don't know how to do email, but I can make phone calls. And she would make phone calls, and people would bring in items. She would encourage people to donate to the project. So we've had a lot of good people working with us. Her family never got paid a dime. Ms. Dorothy was injured severely. Her husband was killed, and she wanted to see this project succeed. My mother wanted to see it succeed. We have the union leaders, you know, the former union leaders from Thigh Call, and they work with the workers and work with the families, and we're working with the fire departments and the nurses to bring in the city's artifacts. But to tell you the truth, we took a beating online. In 2016, we know that there's 320 million people in America, and we believed in our cause. We went online at the White House website, and we asked people to support the Presidential Freedom Award to be awarded to these patriots posthumously. We only got 500 people to support it. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't get to the president's desk. What we want America to do is pause as we have and remember and honor. There were 29 people killed in 1971. There was one person killed in 1973. That person in 1973, his name is Joseph Wainwright. He was a Vietnam veteran. He came back to Camden County. He worked at the Thigh Call plant. He was killed in an 81-millimeter explosion. So that operation out there never ceased. It never ceased. And so we want our people to be remembered and honored, either with the Presidential Freedom Award, which we have posed to President Trump. We also posed to him of creating a Thigh Call Memorial National Park here in Southeast Georgia. President Trump did make the referral to the Southeastern Department of Interior. We went to Congressman, we met with Congressman Buddy Carter, and we have written letters and have gotten a response from Senator Perdue regarding a congressional gold medal.
One thing that stuck to me, too, was just how radical of a change Thigh Call was in Camden County to the people there, and how it really was life-changing and ever since the word.
Yes, it was, because women that couldn't work, I mean, you had college-educated women that were, they couldn't work before 1964 without the permission of their husbands. With Title VII in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, these women were free to go and get a job. You know, where they couldn't have a bank account, where their passports were issued as Mrs. John Doe, these people got freedom. The women joined the workforce. The workforce at Thigh Call was unique. It was women and men and people of different ethnic origin working side by side. So, you know, like in the first 29 people that were killed, you have the valedictorian of the high school was killed. You have the lady that two or three ladies that were going back to college, they were college students. You had school teachers. You had all of these people that had been denied. They had opportunity, and they were very hopeful people. That's why this year at the 48th anniversary ceremony, which will be held February the 3rd, 2019, our theme in the coming year is On the Wings of Hope. These people anticipated a good outcome of their life, and they were always hopeful. These were the people that their attitude brought $1 million cooperation to our shores. These are the same people that when our nation had a vision of going to the moon, they tested a rocket engine that was the most powerful in the world at that time, that Saturday morning, February 27, 1965, that 3 million-pound thrust. These are the same people that supported an entire military and helped free a country, millions of people, but yet and still they were forgotten in American history. And so this is why this ceremony coming up, which we have an annual ceremony to remember the fallen and the patriots that's living and all of those great first responders, the nurses, the doctors, the civilian and military people, that when their soul was required to provide a service to another person, they did not back up. They overcame this tragedy. They triumphed, that human spirit that triumphed over and took out this tragedy, and they stood with us as we buried our fallen, and they took care of the children. So this is a fantastic history. It's about what America is about, and I just want America to do the right thing. I want them to, if they have a Vietnam museum in Washington, I want all 30 of our people's names to go inside that museum. I want America to come together and recognize these people's service and build that national park here so that we can teach our children that there is hope and how these people overcame segregation, how they overcame the parity in American society and built us to where we are now. Now when you get sick, you can dial 911 and get an ambulance. Now you can travel through South Georgia on I-95. And we also recently got approval to have Exit 7 dedicated to the 30 people killed. We're trying to raise funds to pay for the signs. It's moving forward, that resolution to the state, and we're hoping to get clearance. We did ask that Harris Bluff Road be renamed Thicall Memorial Parkway. And people that don't know history in this county, that road was once called the Old Thicall Road. That was the purpose of that road from 17 to the gate of that plant. Now, we understand that Spaceport is coming, but before Spaceport and because of Thicall, Spaceport is coming to the same 7,400 acres of land where Thicall used to exist.
To explain, so the Camden County's new plan for that site, which has been there, it's still there, it's not in operation right now, they're going to build a spaceport for basically the main hub for getting in and out of space in Camden County.
Oh, right, for there. Launching.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
It's a NASA project?
No, it's not a NASA project. They're calling it Camden Spaceport. I don't know really many details of it, but
I think a lot of people are.
Okay. Camden County's got its own rockets, I guess. Maybe
Camden
that's
County is this wants to be at the forefront of the space race again. Growing up in Georgia, I'd never heard of the Thicall explosion, which surprised me. I mean, it seems like something that you would have thought would be covered, at least in Georgia, in our school curriculum, and it wasn't, which is why I think it's really amazing what you've done with the museum and your efforts to get the interchange dedicated. I know you guys are fundraising right now for that, and you've gotten the committee approvals, and you're moving that ahead to the state assembly. But once you get that approved, you're going to need funding to actually have the signs changed. So can you tell the listeners where they can donate if they want to contribute to that?
Yes, if you want to donate to the cause, you can go to our website. That's thicallmemorial.org/donate. And just click on the donate button and donate your funds to doing that sign. Because we have to have 4 signs and 8 posts. And we have to, the state will install them and then we'll have a dedication.
How much do you need to raise? How much do you need to raise?
We need to raise $3,000 for that project.
Okay. All right. Well, hopefully our listeners will step up and give you the final push through that and move this along, because I know how much effort you've put into this, and it's just a matter of time before it sees fruition. So
the reason we have the museum here is after we failed to get those votes for the Presidential Freedom Award online, a young man, his name is Rodney, his mother was killed at the plant, Sandra Ross, and he came to me and he said, "Miss Janie," he said, "don't feel disheartened." He says, "You have so many great artifacts." He said, "Don't wait for the national park." He says, "Start right here, right now." He said, "You can do it. Let's build this museum within your office." And we did it, you know. Wow. He said, "Just start right here, right now, and then people can visualize where the project is going."
And if you're in Camden County, you can check out the museum. It's in Kingsland, not far off 95. Check out the website and visit it.
Yeah, we have a Facebook page, too. It's facebook.com/Thicall. And, people, we're trying to, get more people to come into our Facebook page. Every year we raise funds. We have the anniversary observance. We operate the museum. We visit people. We are like a repository for all things that are Thiokol. And we exist off the generosity of others. And we recognize our sponsors and donors within the museum. And so we have been building towards something, an appreciation in the grace of God and how the human spirit overcomes all things.
Thank you so much, Janie.
Thank you.
The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Do you want to make a website about the growing problem of civil asset forfeiture? Do you want to make a website about Texas now using 3D printers to print dentures for their inmates? Do you want to create a fan page for Get Shorty, the best show on TV? Squarespace has got you covered. With Squarespace, you can create a beautiful website to turn your cool idea into a new website, showcase your work, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, promote your physical or online business, and announce an upcoming project or special event. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, analytics that help you grow in real time, built-in search engine optimization, free and secure hosting, nothing to patch or upgrade ever, and 24/7 award-winning customer support. Just head to squarespace.com/undisclosed for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code undisclosed to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Susan, let's move to some of the other issues that were raised in episode 20 this week, starting with the election pressures. First of all, that song, can we talk about the song?
We can talk about the song. I found it by looking deep into the old Camden County Internet War web pages. Someone had uploaded it in like 2007 or 8 and just like left it there.
Well,
and I found it.
A campaign song?
It was. And I knew it existed. I'd heard about it, but I didn't think I'd ever get a copy. And then I found it on this page one day and it was like,
amazing. Ah. What a find.
You know, it's kind of catchy.
It totally was.
I'll put it up somewhere so everyone can hear it.
Send the link or we'll tweet it out or something like that. All right. So let's talk a little bit about why Sheriff Smith wanted the Swain case solved, what it had to do with the election.
Well, Camden County has had, you know, for a long time, Sheriff Smith's in power, and he was in a strong electoral position. Going into the late 90s, early 2000s, I think there were signs that he had a little bit less power than he once had, but it wasn't a case of he was like in imminent fear of being voted out of office. He was coming from a place of strength. But at the same time, there were a lot of people who were not happy about the fact that the Swain case never gotten solved, and they didn't understand why it never gotten solved. So that was something that was hanging on to him. It is very clear that Sheriff Smith was heavily involved throughout the entire case and very pressured. And you can see, like, in the DA's notes and the police notes, this constant, like, Sheriff Smith called again. He wanted to know, like, when that indictment was coming down or when that grand jury was coming back.
I mean, he was riding on, like, you know, I don't know, years, decades of Sheriff Smith. So he had lots of voter support. It wasn't like, you know, this case would make or break the election for him, right?
No, I don't think at all that was the case. But at the same time, it was also something that kept coming back. It was something that was continually harped on, and it was not something that he wanted to have hanging over him, which I mean, you can tell on the day that the grand jury came back with indicting him for the murders. There's notes from someone in the file talking about how, like, every half hour Sheriff Smith is calling, like, is there an update? It better be done by this Friday. If it's not done by this Friday, you're going to get fired.
Okay, so, you know, there were political motivations to get this case solved, right? And do you think that is part of the pressure of how it went down the way it did?
Yes, it seems very much like that, just from the way that Sheriff Smith was continually hounding over this. And at one point, the DA is, like, writing internal memos, and they're like, Sheriff Smith called again. As usual, the sheriff only heard what he wanted to hear last time we talked about getting the indictment in. But this also goes to why, like, some people in Camden County today also say that the opposition to Dennis Prairie's conviction is politically motivated. And they're not necessarily wrong in that it's hard to escape political motivations for anyone involved here. Because, again, Tommy Gregory, the man who ran against Sheriff Smith and won in 08, that's the son of Joe Gregory, who was the GBI agent who originally investigated the case and who believed Dennis Prairie was innocent.
Was he the agent who verified his alibi?
Yes, he's the one who went and talked to the people at the concrete plant where Dennis worked, and also the one who got his picture and showed it. So what he did, or testified to, is that he showed this picture and a lineup to Vanzola Williams and other witnesses, but those records of that were not in the file when it came time for Dennis Perry's conviction, our trial.
Right.
Marcia, have you read Praying for Sheetrock?
No, I haven't.
You need to.
It sounds really fascinating.
It's a great book. I wouldn't say it's the same at all. I mean, it's a different county, different dynamics at play, but just the general structure of what the sheriff was like and the powers they had back then. It's a good explanation of that. Early in the season when I was down there in Camden County, I was talking to you about like stuff I was seeing, and nothing I talked about was a surprise to you.
Right. Everything about Camden County is kind of straight out of the, I would say, distinctly Southern playbook of how people, like I said on the show, how they kind of maintain the balance of power, how people spend time together. So one of the things that a lot of people talk about is the different brands of racism that you find in different parts of the country. And there's a sense, I think, especially in recent politics, when people mischaracterize the South as either woefully backward or really regressive, that it's often done in a tone that eliminates the realities of racism in northern cities. And sometimes you hear people say, I prefer southern racism because it's clear and there's rules of engagement versus northern racism that feels like, you know, 1,000 tiny little pricks. And so I think the Camden County stories that you're telling, I think the thing that really resonates with me is the fact that people have these unspoken agreements about how to maintain the balance of power, how to ask for things for people in authority. And this is how you have these sheriffs who are deeply problematic, but are able to maintain some goodwill with Black voters and the larger Black community. The other thing that I think is interesting to think about this as a story about Georgia, especially when, you know, Janie was telling us about the way that the Thiokol disaster is very much a story about Black women working in the South, is to think about the recent election for Georgia governor and the ways that the election was essentially stolen from Stacey Abrams. And the fact that in a lot of these places where there are these Black progressive candidates who are emerging, that they are getting voters, that they are getting African-Americans who are disrupting the power system and voting them and supporting them, even after a long history of voting for some of these white candidates. And then the mechanism of voter suppression comes right in to make sure that people don't get too far. And so I think that instead of thinking of Southern politics as a story of a kind of extreme repression, which is accurate to some degree, I think it's more interesting to think about the ways that people navigate and how people kind of work within those systems to survive. And I think a lot of the things that you're highlighting in the story really reveal that.
You know, I was listening to your interview, Marcia, on this week's episode, as you talked about like kind of these kind of uneasy, but just mutually understood boundaries between communities in the South. And I thought, you know, I grew up in Western Maryland, not too far from the Mason-Dixon line, but still, you know, north of it. When I'm thinking back, I think it was kind of the same there. And I feel like even in outside of the South, I think even like, you know, up in North, even in urban areas, I mean, you kind of find the same thing. Even where I live now, I'm in the suburbs of DC, and it's, you know, where the white folk live and you know where the Black folk live. And, you know, I could recognize that even though I've never grown up in the South.
Right. Like, so segregation is particularly powerful because it makes inevitable inequality and separation that is really about, you know, the meeting of personal choice and public policy. So anyone can live wherever they want, technically, right?
Right.
And the law is supposed to fight any attempts to, you know, preclude people from living wherever they want. We all understand that. But the way that it plays out is, yes, a person can move into a neighborhood where they're an outsider and then speculate about the consequences of that. So they just don't do it. And we also know that this has serious economic implications. There was that recent study that came out a couple weeks ago that said, essentially, African-American homebuyers, even if they live in a neighborhood that's comparable to whites, their house will be worth $40,000 to $50,000 less than a comparable white homeowner based on just the optics of segregation. And so when we think about then why people make the choices that they make, it's understandable why a person feels particularly intimidated or it doesn't even occur to them to challenge some of these enforced boundaries. And so I think that this story, especially about the ways that the Swain murders kind of expose how all of the dynamics play out is helpful for us to understand that, A, this is not about the past, that this is very much people's lives today. And I also think it really helps eliminate this kind of these fantasies that I think most people have that they are going to be the person who stands up for justice. Most people do not do that. And so when there are people who push the system and push the boundaries, I think we just have a greater appreciation for them because they are few and far between in these systems that are so overwhelming. They're so scary. The threat of violence, the threat that your car will be pulled over and your assets will be seized or you'll be accused of running drugs. I mean, there's a lot to fear in this community. And the fact that there are a few people who will say, you know what, something's wrong, we should try to fight it, is pretty remarkable.
And that's one of the tragedies that hit me about Thiokol, is that what the workforce they were making there was, in its own way, very progressive. It was very integrated. I mean, a lot of the workers were Black and female, but they were getting opportunities they hadn't had before. And the workforce was, I mean, it was white men, Black men. It was everyone working together, like on the assembly lines of the factory. And you didn't see that. I mean, in Camden County, you didn't see that.
Right.
And it really was changing lives, and then have it all taken away was such a big tragedy.
Well, I think the thing about the story that's so fascinating, you know, like Janie said earlier, she said, you know, we had women who had college degrees who were working there. And there's something about the fact that the best option other than cleaning cabins is to work in a factory with hazardous material that's being used as an agent of war overseas. Right. It really kind of gets to the heart of just how constrained opportunities are for African Americans in that period of time. And I would say to an extent today, where people's choices are, how do you mitigate as much risk and how do you insulate yourself and your family from the most harm? And working in a chemical plant is one of the best options. It really highlights just how these dynamics work. But an interracial factory floor is a pretty radical idea. And even in states that have worker protections and are pretty pro-union, it's really hard for people of color to get into unions, even today, to get the kind of high-quality manufacturing and trade jobs. And so it's interesting to think about the ways that both the Democratic and Republican Party are saying, you know, the future is skilled labor, we're going to bring back these jobs. But rarely do people take a step back and say, who has traditionally had these jobs and who is getting excluded from these jobs and these work opportunities. And I think that I hope that through the story being told on this podcast and people just being really curious about what does it mean when this kind of disaster happens in such a small location and people are completely cut out of any kind of reparations or any kind of justice after it happens.
For me, saying the best explanation of the dynamics of Camden County was the Steve Barry memo from the Dr. Chua case. And when I saw it, I mean, I'll post it on the site if I haven't already, but it's just a memo that was written up as part of this case. And Steve Barry, the county commissioner, is giving advice to the prosecutor, Jackie Johnson, not related to John Johnson, about how to win the case, essentially. And his advice was, don't put Blacks in the jury. And it wasn't coming from a place of like explicit racism in that he didn't like Blacks on juries in general. He didn't like the idea of having Black people on this jury for a case that a sheriff didn't want to see a conviction in.
I mean, first of all, this is just exactly why, you know, we can have, again, you're not allowed to discriminate, you know, in housing, you're not allowed to discriminate in public accommodation. So you just hope that history does its job and just keeps people in their places. But when it can't, or when there's a threat to it, people will say these very explicit things. And we know the problems with jury selection. And we know the ways that race and ideas about race can be used in the formation of a jury, as long as you don't take notes and say it. And so
that's what went wrong in this time, is actually, you know, they said it out loud.
I think the problem is that, you know, we have such interesting pieces of legislation, and we even have pieces of legislation that dictate that we have to take a lot of data, but we don't have a court system that actually mediates any of these breaches.
And there's a ton, in this case, like in the Dennis Perry case, there is a ton of data taken on the jury, like makeup and like comparisons against Glynn County as a whole, to make sure that there was like an even field going in there. But notice, despite all that, not a single Black man made it onto the jury.
That's really fascinating. I mean, that's so fascinating. And the other thing about the, you know, about juries in general, and we've talked about this on the addendum before, is that it is really hard to know what to do when you're on a jury.
Yeah.
And so part of the problem, I think, with the jury system is that the level of education, reading comprehension, and abstract thinking that you need to serve effectively and fairly on a jury in places in which there's these deep educational disparities or even access to understanding the justice system embeds in it a discriminatory mechanism without needing to discriminate. You know, I live in Washington, D.C., and you know, Susan, I guess you get called to jury duty a lot.
I've gotten called one time, and I was like, the one time I took a vacation, I was so upset. No.
And, you know, every time I go, I never get seated because it's just not going to happen. But one of the things that's interesting about it is there are a lot of African-Americans in Washington, D.C., and many of them may have an opportunity to be on the jury, but I think because of some of the dynamics of education and social class and access, as well as prior involvement, either as someone who's been involved in a criminal case, peripherally a victim of crime, know someone who's a victim of crime, you start to see the ways that it constricts this supposedly democratic process. And so, you know, I think the thing about Camden County that makes it particularly fascinating is that people don't mask all of their malfeasance, so we can talk about it. But I'm not sure it's the only place where these things happen.
No, it definitely isn't. I mean, I don't think Camden County is unique in a lot of ways, but this is definitely not a dynamic that's unique in any way to the South or outside of the South. But there is, I would think it would be fair to say that there is a certain level of openness there that you might not find in every county. And it's also because it's so well established, like the dynamics are in place. And there's almost like a weirdly democratic vibe to it, which is probably the wrong use of the word, but there is an openness to it that allows people to sort of maybe navigate things more easily.
Like everyone's reading from the same script.
Yeah.
And I also think, again, like, you know, the chilling effect of racial violence is something that like we can never overestimate. And so, you know, for some of the residents of this county who have lived there for generations, all they need is the story that's passed down about what happened to a grandparent or what happened to a friend of the family, what happened to a person who asked too many questions, for them to like fully know the extent in which this is a place where, you know, shaking the wrong tree can get you severely injured or just limit your already limited opportunities. I think that whole conversation you had with that woman about the pool is fascinating because I think we're all about the same age. And it's just really, you know, it's pitch perfect that she's like, yeah, there was a pool and Black people weren't allowed in it. Yeah, it was a thing.
And then she said in high school, and I was like, wait.
Want to make sure nothing comes between you and protecting your family this holiday and save hundreds of dollars while you're at it? You need SimpliSafe Home Security. If a storm takes out your power, SimpliSafe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, SimpliSafe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, SimpliSafe will still get you the help you need. And here's what I love about this. Maybe it's overkill, maybe it's the last thing you want to think about this holiday. But with SimpliSafe, you're always ready for anything. They believe nothing should get between you and protecting your family. That's why SimpliSafe doesn't cost an arm and a leg. It could, but it doesn't. They charge you what's fair, what's right. $14.99 a month. No contracts, no markups, and there's no installation window. It's so easy, you'll have it up and running in just minutes. Now, I've been using SimpliSafe for the past few years, and I've never felt safer. That's why I recommend SimpliSafe to everyone I know, especially this holiday when you have everything to be thankful for, everything to protect. And today, you can save hundreds of dollars on that protection if you go to simplysafeundisclosed.com. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com. Make sure to use that URL because that's how they know what to send you. But hurry, this holiday offer's ending soon. Again, simplysafeundisclosed.com.
With respect to what you just mentioned, Marsha, about, you know, people, these stories that are handed down, I mean, do people even have to reach that far back when we have, you know, police shootings with, you know, racial implications just as recently as a few months ago in Camden County? And Susan, can you tell us about what that incident is?
Yeah, well, when I was down there this summer, there was a police shooting. There was an unarmed man who apparently the police have been like regular harassing, and he was shot and killed. And there was a lot of protests going on. When I was down there at the Thayer Comedy Museum, there were protesters organizing, which I don't think was, from my sense was, and talking to people, was not a common thing in Camden County. Mm-hmm. The man was charged, I believe, with voluntary manslaughter. So it's not being completely ignored, but it was interesting to watch this play out after having been down there and people tell me that there were never really racial issues, and then to see that people were organizing against it.
Well, one of the things I think is also straight from the playbook, I'm sure while that organizing was happening, that there was a segment of the population that was blaming television for it. There's a narrative in the South that when people organize against any kind of an injustice, that it's the result of outside agitators. And this is like classic language. It's used in Ferguson. It can be used in big cities like Chicago. There will always be people who believe that there are these people who are just provocateurs who are riling up the local community or bringing other people to pretend it's the local community. But the real insight is that everything's fine and our people know what's right. And so I would be really
fascinated. So these outsiders are riling up the good blacks, basically.
Or they're just bringing their own people to pretend that there's a problem. And, you know, this would, you know, people in 1964 in Mississippi would say this, like, oh, no one has a problem with, you know, being killed, not being allowed to vote, not having access to, you know, food and education for our kids. It's just other people put this idea. And I think that it's really amazing way of not only reducing the important history of activism among Southerners, but it also suggests that at the end of the day, when the dust settles, we will know how again to like reestablish our power.
At the same time, it's worth noting there's a reason that Sheriff Smith had such support among Black community. And I heard a lot of stories down there about how people had, Sheriff Smith had helped them, gone out of his way to help them even, consistently and regularly. Things like making sure they had bond, they did get arrested. Things that you would see as normally outside the typical role of law enforcement and more in line with this role of high sheriff. So that was real. That was happening. When I was down in Thiokol, actually, I was talking to a woman who told me about how one time she'd had a relative that was, there was a problem at the jail and her son and others were being beaten by the guards there. And her response was to literally walk into the sheriff's office and tell him he needed to fix this. And she could do that. That was not like a surprising thing. That was a kind of access that was expected and normal in Camden County. So you had like the contrast of like the horrific beating of inmates who can't defend themselves at a jail. But at the same time, a Black woman in Camden County would feel comfortable just like storming in the sheriff's office and saying, you got to fix this.
Right. And I think that's how this system works, that these occasional acts of benevolence, or even let's say that they're genuine kindness, that they are also a way of depositing goodwill or depositing some type of, you know, latitude for when it is bigger stuff, when he needs to get, you know, voted out of office for corruption or obstruction. And I think that, you know, even Svengali had his cuddly days. And so I think that when we think about these as not just instances in which people are all bad or all good, but we see how power and favor is manipulated. Because in him intervening on behalf of a jailhouse beating, he's also insulating the department from that person maybe filing suit or asking the Department of Justice to come down and take a look at what's going on or organizing other people and saying, even though the sheriff intervened, this is unacceptable. And so I think that there's a way that the little fires get extinguished in a community like that in order to keep the kind of roaring fire that's surrounding the town from being extinguished.
Yeah.
I just want to really emphasize how amazing it is that local residents are really trying to preserve this important history. I've been involved in a lot of really bad conversations about Confederate memorials and people just going out of their ways to say that you have to have these symbols of hate up and about. But one of the things that I hope that conversation can inspire is a conversation about local history and the work that people can do to make sure that important stories are not kind of left to the waysides. And so I think it's amazing that there are people in a local community who are refusing to forget, because in order for this type of tragedy to not go down again, in which a corporation kind of can take control of something that they caused and not have to take responsibility for, there has to be a deep understanding of the local history of workers and their sacrifices. So I just think it's amazing that this project is coming together. And I hope that some of the listeners can really think about ways that they can support it.
Yes. And I'm just so impressed with what Janie has done down there. And I mean, part of it started just not being appalled that I'd never heard of it before. I felt like kind of like stupid that I hadn't heard of something that I felt like I should have heard of and would have wanted to know of. And Janie told me at one point, she's like, there's just things people don't want to talk about. They're quiet about, like the Swain case and like Thiokol, that they need to talk about. And getting people to talk in Camden County has not been easy. Some people are happy to talk. Some people will just tell you how it is. And they're like, you know what? I've seen it all. I don't care anymore. I'm done with this. Not done with this, but they're done with the silence. But a lot of people in Camden County will not say a word about any of this. And their motives are probably all over the place. And I think part of it's just, it's an uncomfortable topic to talk about. And it makes people, there was a piece, now that it was solved, someone's convicted, and the idea of dredging it all up again or building a memorial to Thiokol bothers them.
Yeah, I understand the impulse to stay quiet. And I think that if people understood how their testimony could be powerful, and if they ever had an experience in which their testimony was respected and taken seriously, they would do more of it. And so hopefully, I think it's a generational shift. I think it's a distance and time shift that, you know, there would be future generations that understand the power of telling your story. Because really, that's the first step in making a difference.
Well, thank you so much, Marsha, for joining us. I really appreciate it. I love having you on. You are, don't tell anyone else this, but you're my favorite guest for the addendum.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always to chat with the Undisclosed team. Thanks so much, Susan.
Well, that's all for the second to last addendum of season 3 of Undisclosed. We'll be back on Monday with episode 21, the final episode in the series.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Christy Williams and Nina Musser for website management, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.